Blog Talk Radio.
Welcome to Inner Voice Intuitive Hour with your host, Jenny Seek.
Hi, folks. This is Jenny Seek, and this is your weekly forum for connecting with your intuitive process, all things metaphysical, and honoring and recognizing your soul self. Thanks for tuning in, and enjoy the ride.
Hi, everybody. Thanks so much for listening to Inner Voice Intuitive Hour. Thanks for choosing to spend your Tuesday night with us. If you're new to Inner Voice, I want to let you know this is a forum for people who are interested in understanding the depths of themselves, understanding what makes them tick, not just on a conscious level, but on an unconscious level. So connecting with that inner part of the self. To figure out what's there, to figure out what their calling is, what they're meant to do in the world. And one great way to do that is to connect to your intuition. So if those topics are of interest to you, you're in a great place this evening. I want to thank you for listening to the show. And if you haven't, make sure to share your pretty picture with Inner Voice so that you can follow the show and find out what's happening, what's on upcoming programs. Right now, we don't have any upcoming guests. I ran the docket out, and I have to get some other people on the list. So I will be doing that in the very near future. And with no further ado, I want to introduce our guest tonight. Tonight, we have Drake Spieth. Drake Spieth is a PsyD, and he is the co-founder of Earth Traditions. He's a shamanic counselor, a licensed clinical psychologist, an ordained minister, and he's certified in death midwifery. He's a faculty member at the Chicago School of Professional Psychology, and he's authored several entries in the Encyclopedia of Psychology and Religion. I'm not going to go through his whole dossier because it's pretty long, but I want to get him on the line now so that we can directly talk to him and find out what some of these wonderful things are. Hi, Drake, are you there?
I am. Thank you, Jenny. It's a pleasure to be here and talk to you.
Awesome. Very cool. Well, I see that you have done so many things in your career and in your life around these topics, and clearly it's something that you're very passionate about and that has had a trajectory of its own. I love the fact that you have, you know, gone the route of a more academic or traditional journey with getting the PsyD and doing the work as a clinical psychologist, but then you've added to it the spiritual dimension, which I think is so needed in our world right now. Can you talk about what led you in those two different directions and how you found a bridge between the two?
Well, I think the most honest answer to your question in many ways is a restlessness that has refused to allow me to be happy doing just one thing. I always feel like the best in my life when I seem to be able to wear multiple hats to try to do a little of this and a little of that. But in all honesty, I think that my interest and love of spirituality, in hindsight, it seems meaningful to say that it was almost inevitable. I just cannot see true healing happening without engaging the spiritual dimension. And I have even been known to fairly radically tell my students that I feel that the psychotherapy relationship at its best is not only a relationship that heals, it is in fact a spiritual relationship and one of connection with the soul of the client. I think that we have gotten away in psychology from using the language of psyche, logos, and we've forgotten that we're speaking the speech of the soul, kind of getting into the knowledge of the spirit, you know, the science of breath, a lot of ways to play with those Greek terms. But I love to try to remind my students that maybe, perhaps archetypally, we're linked to an ancient line of healers that have indeed done that. And for me, the whole shamanic thing is a way of capturing some of that ancient lineage and sort of a respect for the care of the soul that we're doing.
I think that's so wonderful, and I think it's so, so important to note exactly what you're saying, that I think psychology has grown away from this connection with the soul and this larger connection with our relationship to divinity or the divine, the numinous, if you will. And I think that it's so important with each client to notice energetically where they are around those sorts of issues and help them to connect with their creative process and help them connect with a deeper sense of who they are and their intuition and all of those really good juicy things, because that's really, you know, I think why we're here, not the getting and spending or the, you know, the pieces that traditional psychology is more adjustment related often and less related to really figuring out what our bliss is. And so I just really appreciate the fact that you are aware of that, and I'm sure you bring that into your classroom as well.
I certainly try.
Awesome, awesome. So I want to ask you a little bit, for folks who are not familiar with some of these terms here, what is a shamanic counselor and how do they differ from a more traditional kind of approach to counseling?
Well, for me, a shamanic counselor, this is a term that I use in a very sort of specific way, and it reflects for me the fact that I have trained with the Crow's Nest Center for Shamanic Studies for almost 3 years now. And the gentleman who runs that center, C. Michael Smith, also known in some circles, McCall, has indeed also learned in a couple of indigenous traditions. And he has some of the more mainstream approaches and the Jungian approaches as well. But one of the issues that he's certainly been respectful of and has been a good role model for me in this regard is the very real issue and painful issue of cultural appropriation that's come, unfortunately, with the term shaman or shamanism. Academia, anthropology, and now more recently psychology, has really made use of this term in a big way and has not been so great at acknowledging the fact that it actually comes from a very specific Siberian indigenous tradition. It's arguably a derivation of a Tungusic word, and there have been endless scholarly debates about what it means and where it comes from. Some feel that it has a tie to Hindi and perhaps has a meaning like poor monk. Others feel that it has ties to other traditions as well and has a connotation of wisdom or knowledge gained from spirits. The fact is, no one knows for sure, but it does seem directly tied to that Tungusic tradition, and it's something that really sort of belongs to them. Well, for a long time now, scholars have used the term to loosely apply to indigenous healers and other types of healers who do very similar things, and it's been great as a frame of reference and a term of convenience. But I do feel strongly that wherever possible, we ought to try to use the words in those traditions for those healers using their languages. If, you know, one thing that McCall has pointed out, for instance, it would be like someone claiming the term rabbi who's never been to a rabbinical training, how strange it would be out of context, you know, in terms of the context using it as well as for the Jewish tradition. So we need to be respectful where we can. All I can do is acknowledge the difficulty with that and pay my very deep respect and debt of gratitude toward the line of teachings that I've received and pay homage to all my teachers along the way. So when I use the word shamanic to describe the counseling that I bring and all of that, it's a way of paying heed to the very strong connections to those indigenous traditions that I've picked up there. But I do dislike other words, you know, and kind of corruptions, what I see as corruptions of it, like shamanist or those especially who very casually and loosely appropriate for themselves the term shaman. I do believe there are shamans, and I think it's a term that's earned out of time and practice and hard work, and it's given, bestowed by the community. And it's almost like the status of elder. It's something that you earn with practice. So, you know, I've typically used shamanic practitioner or shamanic counselor to pay respect to the fact that I have learned a lot, and I am incorporating soul and spirit in ways that really are connected to some of those things. But I would not call myself a shaman, and I dislike corruptions of the word, that lead to things like shamanist or whatever.
Yeah, I'm not sure where I thought that I'd seen that on your page. I'm sure it was my mistake when I posted it that way. And I guess it gave us a teachable moment. I guess it gave us a chance to talk about this issue and talk about cultural appropriation and how important it is to take note, take heed, be aware, and honor the people who started the tradition and coined the term. So I really appreciate that.
Indeed. Well, I think it's an opportunity for a great discussion, and got me thinking a little bit earlier today, too, reflecting on just some of the definitions of shaman that I've come across. And I was recalling that I had read some years back Stephen Larson's book, The Shaman's Doorway, and he really does a nice job talking about how, you know, whatever healer you have in indigenous traditions working in a way that might fit the description that academics have used for shamans, one thing they do well is create a doorway. And it's a type of doorway that's really needed in these times when we've been so alienated from the natural world and are suffering some of the psychic poison, if you will, or the sort of spiritual soul loss from the lack of connection with our humanity and with the natural world. So the idea of allowing for this doorway back to the soul, or through which the soul can re-enter in order to, quote, recover, or, you know, to have soul retrieval work done. Something that came to me pretty strongly, in fact, is that even more than that, the shaman or those who work in this role are the doorway many times. And I really identify with this idea that when we work this way, we are a door, and we are a door for those for whom we're working, as well as ourselves in that regard.
Yeah, absolutely. I really appreciate that, too, that whole idea of witnessing or watching what your client is doing and helping mirror for them a little bit what's going on in the process, but really recognizing that they're doing the work and that it's their process, and that when they walk through the door, when they connect with a sense of their deeper self, we're just holding the space for them to do that.
Very much so.
Very cool. Awesome. So I guess I do want to ask you a little bit, I think I touched on it before, but I want to ask you a little bit about how shamanic counseling differs from more traditional kinds of counseling. What are the sorts of things that someone might experience if they went to someone such as yourself, a shamanic counselor?
Well, for me, it really means connecting with the heart more openly, organically, naturally, and fully, rather than the head. And one common theme that seems to emerge from indigenous traditions is that the head, the brain, however you sort of see what happens with the head, is a great, great instrument and tool. I love to use mine. I love to exalt in ideas and concepts. I mean, one of the elements I work so well in teaching is air, you know, so the idea of communication and the exchange of ideas and insights and values and attitudes and philosophies, I love that and can engage in it for, you know, long periods of time. But when it comes to real healing, the heart is what's necessary, and the head ought to be the servant of the heart, not the other way around. And again, I pay homage to McCall, who is the first I've heard say it quite like that. And it comes from Jungian psychology as well. From the Red Book, we've learned that, you know, Jung's process of his own journey into his soul really mirrored in some ways the work of those we call shamans and what they do. And he discovered for himself the importance of the heart and all of that. Mm-hmm. One of his teachers in his whole journey was the biblical figure of Salome, you know, the one who demanded the head of John the Baptist on a silver platter. And he spent quite a while trying to understand her role. And it came to him as an epiphany that she was there to cut off his head because he was entirely in love with his own brilliance and not enough connected to his heart. And so in order to be a more effective healer himself, he needed to fully open his heart. And that was one of many beautiful things that came out of his journey and his process with the Red Book. So I feel that when we connect in the role of shamanic counselor, we're keeping those things close to the heart in our work, and we're helping those with whom we work get in touch with the felt sense, if you will, to borrow from Eugene Genlin and his work on focusing, that which our bodies want, that which our spirits want, our psyches want. What does our heart crave? And then what is getting in the way of those kinds of things? And when the head sort of gets out of the way of understanding that, sometimes things seem a lot more simple and clear than we end up making them in our lives. So in contrast to clinical psychology, which really is all about this idea of pathology and a mental illness model that's dependent on the medical model and our love of diagnosis and DSM-5 is about to come out in April and May. In contrast to those things, this is a way of connecting with the heart, honoring the healing relationship that's in place, and understanding that psychotherapy, as it's been traditionally practiced, simply does not have a monopoly on those things.
Awesome. Yeah, I think it's so important to go into a place with of the heart with clients. I think it is something our culture really, really glorifies the role of the head, and I think it can be a trap, even though, like what you're saying about the air energy and honoring ideas and philosophy and how wonderful it is and stuff, it can be a trap if we stay there too long or we don't recognize that that's where we're at in relationship to the heart or in relationship to the body. And I think it's so important to recognize the distinction for ourselves and to help our clients recognize the distinction as well. And I love the fact that you're talking about Eugene Genlin's work with focusing, because I think that's right where it's at. It's about getting a sense of what's true or real for you, and that's a more subjective relationship to the heart and to, you know, the psyche than what traditional Western psychology, you know, postulates or cares about. It seems like that's often just a trap, because that gets us in our head and thinking about our thinking errors, and it re-pathologizes us to a certain extent. It makes us stay in the place where there's only black or white or good or bad thinking. There isn't a refinement or a deeper awareness about what feels right.
I agree 1,000%. And I think Genlin's work represents another door and a gateway for psychotherapy into spirituality and spiritual work with clients. I believe that once they get in touch with that bodily felt sense and those little shifts in awareness that take place, that they see as, that they sense as body-centered, that helps them develop, you know, that spiritual sense of intuition and empathy, and often leads to these sort of mystical leaps that are very difficult to reduce and describe in purely intellectual terms and or reduce to some sort of medical or pseudo-medical understanding.
I think that idea of entrainment is kind of what Genlin is talking about, you know, that you kind of know when you feel something. You know when you go to that place of bliss or that place of a deepening awareness or felt sense shift. You have a sense, and then you can start to string those experiences together and know where the energy is for you. And I think that entrainment idea is so important.
And children are naturally closer to it, obviously, at the risk of stating the obvious. As adults, we needlessly entangled ourselves and made things way more complicated. And so a lot of this is like returning to that childhood state where we knew what our bodies wanted. We knew what our bodies didn't like, what they loved, you know, whether it was food, whether it was other kinds of life experiences. I can recall a time when I was 3 and I told my mom after she gave me some medicine for some illness that I had that I felt weak, that I felt sick, and it sort of stirred up her psychic sense, if you will. She looked at the prescription and just something seemed off, so she called the pharmacist, who was quite alarmed because apparently I had taken about 5 times the amount of the particular medication that I was supposed to be given because of a typographical error on the drug label. So there was some strong thought from the pharmacist that I might have acted in time, not to be melodramatic, but possibly to save my life because it was, you know, let's just say it was a problematic dose.
Wow.
As a child, I was much more able to do that. I just knew instantly when something was not right with my body, and I feel like I've had to do a lot of work uncovering the layers just simply to get back to that.
Yeah, yeah, I know what you mean. I think, too, sometimes when you're in a more traditional academic setting, it pulls you away from that connection with the heart, you know, that connection with the felt sense. And, you know, there's so many different terms you can use to describe this philosophy or that concept. And it pulls you out of that place of you know, of just being simply in yourself. And I wonder what your experience has been like with that, if you've experienced that in academia and then had to find yourself as a clinician and as a shamanic counselor outside of that other role.
Indeed. Well, I didn't have a long or easy path through academia. I did start at one graduate school, and I ended up transferring to another, and ended up, actually I'm teaching now at the one that I ended up at. But it did take me a long time to get the doctorate. And, you know, part of it, of course, was that there was a part of me that simply wasn't concerned about doing it in a hurry, although the part that was concerned was definitely responding to all of the pressure and how are you going to make a living, and you've done so much, you've incurred so much student loan debt, and, you know, you really need to do something with all of this. Yes, I felt all of that pressure and ended up ultimately in a great place where I finally was able to complete the doctorate. I owe a debt of gratitude to the woman who is currently my wife, because she created a container in which I could complete the dissertation. But it wasn't easy, because part of it was I was really trying to navigate a lot of personal things going on and my own conflicting feelings and love of Jungian psychology, which was not finding a home in conventional psychotherapy training. And things that I felt versus things that I thought I ought to think. And I, you know, I ended up jumping through the hoops in some ways, but it wasn't really until I had had some work under my belt and I had spent 4 years in the Air Force working as a psychologist there. I was at Wright-Patterson Air Force Base and then Lackland Air Force Base for a few years. After I came out of all of that, I developed the courage to start looking into the things that I was interested in that were considered less than mainstream, and I started to make some strong connections, and I developed a little bit more confidence in doing that. And to make a long story short, I ended up really kind of teaching or incorporating some of this heart-centered, holistic emphasis, the importance of the body and its experience, into some of the humanistic existential classes I've been fortunate enough to teach here at the Chicago School. And ultimately, the school's sensitivity to diversity and cultural factors ended up being a gateway into being able to talk about spirituality also as a diversity factor. So I was able to combine, you know, the interest in mysticism and spirituality with some of the more humanistic and existential and transpersonal and heart-centered kinds of ideas. So teaching, I guess, has been the home where I've been able to balance those different poles in my work. And I feel fortunate to have had that place to do that. Could I have done that had I not been in academia? I'm not sure. Probably because I can't help but experience in working with clients the importance of the relationship. And I would like to think that would have given me the confidence and the validation ultimately to do that. But having the responses of students to what I'm talking about, having the support of fellow faculty members, even though I suspect that in both populations, I'm probably regarded as fairly eccentric, there's also a lot of respect that has been very open. And I feel like I do have a home here with all of that. And in that respect, perhaps my experience has been unique and I've been able to balance it. But yes, it is not an easy thing to be a therapist who is not in love with the DSM or diagnosing or thinks the medical model is pretty useless in many respects. Useful for some things. There are organic-based psychoses. There are biologically-based depression conditions that have everything to do with body chemistry. And I think the medical model can be useful potentially in some of those, but I honestly think many of those circumstances are a lot more rare than has been sort of bruited about, as it were. So
yeah.
Take a very dim view, ultimately, of the over-reliance on some of those things. The whole DSM, for instance, was supposed to be a book of working hypotheses. It's not treated that way. And now in the most recent edition, there is a whole opening up of access to the elderly and to younger children for psychotropic medication through some of the diagnoses they're creating. And that's where some of the activist pieces of my soul get engaged.
That's wonderful. I wonder, I'm curious because you talked about eco-psychology in the bio that you gave me. Particularly drawn to the idea of the four sacred elements and looking at earth, air, fire, water, which you talked about a little bit earlier, the idea that you're comfortable in the element of air to a certain extent with your teaching and some of your other work.
Yeah.
I wonder how you use that with clients and if that's a modality that you employ with your clients and how you help them to understand that.
Well, it comes up a lot. I see in my current caseload in my practice that I do outside of the teaching, the vast majority of my caseload are contemporary pagans and people who are very strongly connected to some sort of earth spirituality or earth-centered spiritual practice. So eco-psychology sometimes seems like a no-brainer. They very immediately and intuitively understand the, quote, psychology, unquote, of our relationship to the planet, and that we cannot have well-being individually without considering the well-being of the mother. So that makes it very easy, and it comes in fairly often with them. In cases where I'm not working with a pagan or I'm not working with someone who necessarily practices an earth-centered spiritual tradition, that idea may not be as intuitive, but it's interesting how often that it seems to that therapy or counseling with me seems to go there, and I'm constantly questioning, okay, am I steering this too much? But it, so far, it seems to be sort of an organic emergence that the more someone seems to really be interested in their own health and well-being in their lives, the more they start to really consider social and global and cultural factors, and then ultimately they really start looking at the bigger picture and how we are inextricably connected to the planet and what they can do, in fact, to contribute to their own well-being through contributing to the well-being of the planet. And yes, for pagans and sometimes for others, working in elemental kinds of fashion, you know, with the idea of earth, air, fire, water, spirit, those things can provide a framework where, you know, water is really connected with a lot of things, you know, dreams and intuition and air and speech, communication, fire, passions, earth foundation, you know, the support systems in our lives, et cetera, et cetera. Spirit is terms of the alchemy of how all of those come together as a whole and
awesome.
How the whole is greater than the sum of the parts.
Awesome. Yeah, I think that in light of the fact that, you know, the DSM is only so useful and can sometimes be, I would say, sometimes can be destructive to people's sense of self if it's focused on too stridently at the expense of other ways of seeing things. I just think it's so important to offer other ways of working with energy, like, you know, chakras, like working with earth, air, fire, water, like all of these more kind of Eastern-based or inner kind of ways of responding to, you know, I don't know, what would I say, ways of working with clients, you know, strategies for working with them. I think that those ways are ways that they're drawn to work with themselves, because it's in them and it's around them and it's accessible, as opposed to someone telling them that they have this, you know, disease diagnosis, what have you, and maybe they do to a certain extent have behaviors or whatever, but I think it can be kind of counterproductive sometimes to focus so much on pathology.
Yes, well, there's this thing called confirmatory bias, right?
Mm-hmm.
Where we only see what we expect to see, and more our worldview gets confirmed, and things that challenge our worldview get denied. And, you know, the more we buy into a way of seeing things, the more entrenched we get. So this is why I really love the work of phenomenologists who advocate sort of taking an introspective look at our own assumptions and biases and preconceptions, and the ability to sort of take a step back and mindfully question some of those things so that we can bracket them, if you will, temporarily even set them aside, so that we can see with new eyes the person in front of us, and not see them as a diagnosis, not see them as a label, and have already predicted their future, and in too many cases given an unwarranted message of hopelessness because their condition has a, quote, poor prognosis. I think there's so much harm we inadvertently do, even as therapists, when we convey that kind of a message to the people with whom we're working.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think, too, like that, you know, Jungian psychology or depth psychology kind of ways of looking at things are about the idea that we can rise above any situation, that if we follow our bliss, if we connect with this inner sense of self, if we find certain tools that speak to us, our diagnosis or our prognosis doesn't have to be that way at all. You know, I mean, it's about not being in the place of the ego, but being in the place of the person who's curious about what's going on and curious, finding tools and ways to do things and ways to take themselves more from a more nurturing stance. And who am I in this?
Indeed. And this is why I love existential psychology as well, because anxiety is not a bad word. The things that cause anxiety, and dare I say, even experiences of suffering, have great usefulness in our lives in helping us transform. If we did not have these difficult experiences, and the pure existentialist position is, if we are not aware at some level that one day we are going to die, or that, you know, we will simply not be, if we didn't have that awareness, we wouldn't be capable of the greatness that we are capable of achieving as human beings in our lives, you know, of making it count. And, you know, this resilient capacity that some trauma survivors seem to have of transforming even the darkest, worst, most horrific experiences in their life into some sublime kind of spiritual evolution or healing or other kind of transformative potential is something that continually leaves me just shaking with awe and, you know, feeling very humble in terms of how they achieve that healing in their lives.
Yeah, I think of Peter Levine's book. And I'm not going to remember the name of it, but
Waking the Tiger is the classic.
Waking the Tiger, right, yes. Working with that energy of realizing the place of empowerment in their traumatic story. And I think sometimes in traditional psychology there's a tendency to go too much into into the wound, you know, to go into that place of the wound, when actually I've been finding recently working with folks that a lot of times you don't have to go into the deep, deep part of the wound. If you can find a place of divinity or connection with a greater whole, the thing that helped them to catalyze their own experience of connecting with the divine or connecting with the healing capacity or the survivor capacity of themselves in that kind of shamanic way, that is such a wonderful tool, and that sometimes going into the wound too far can be re-traumatizing.
Mm-hmm. Right on. And the other thing too that I love about Levine's work is it makes us aware that the brain, once again, is not the be-all and end-all of even memory and experience, that our bodies hold trauma, and that memory, in some mysterious way, particularly for trauma survivors, seems to be rooted in the body. And how often have we heard the experiences of body workers who are working with their clients who will say, suddenly, you know, there was a release, you know, of some emotion, some flood of images from some past event, and the person they're working with doesn't understand why, you know, that particular point, you know, that happened. But once they're able to make the connection with their body experience, there's what I would call a soul retrieval or a soul recovery experience that might happen spontaneously. Levine is very good about the description of how trauma is really experienced by the body and stored in the body and expressed in the body, and that it sort of is like a book of all of the traumatic things that have happened to us in our lives. Many of the physical difficulties and problems that we experience, you know, some issues of weight gain or weight loss, issues, you know, related to things that we don't even normally connect with psychological factors, really have experiential and demonstrable connections to past traumas and things that happen. So I think that work in somatic experiencing was groundbreaking in many ways.
Yeah, absolutely. I'm curious, do you do much dream work? Is that something that you do in your practice? Or?
Yes, dreams come up fairly often in discussions I have with people that I see in therapy. I think they're pretty useful ways of kind of, you know, little windows in to the person's psyche. Unlike Jung, I'm a little bit loath to offer authoritative interpretations or bring out, you know, what I see as archetypal things necessarily. I like Robert Moss's approach of saying that if I were the dreamer, here's what I would be tempted to say about this dream I was having. But of course, you're the dreamer and you're the one, you know, who is making the meaning of all of this. So if I offer any thoughts or any opinions about it, I'll do it from that framework. But I always think it's much more useful if the person has that sort of aha on their own and really understands the dream. Even sometimes the literal imagery of the dream has so much potentially to teach them or to show them or reveal about their own struggle for self, that staying in the moment with it sometimes seems so important. So I try to be less authoritative if I can about dream work, and a lot more kind of focusing style in the now, or in the, working in the here and now with how, what's their felt sense of the dream as they're reflecting on it or sort of bringing it back, re-experiencing it, if you will, in the present moment with me there in the session.
Awesome. Yeah, I think it's so cool. I'm really intrigued with this idea of bridging the dream imagery, the felt sense experience of the dream imagery with the waking life, and making a connection between those two, because that's, I think, where that release, you know, that feeling-toned complex that gets backed up in terms of when we're in a fight-or-flight kind of situation where we can really put all of that energy back into our waking life. Not that it should go there, but that that we can really propel some of the energy of our unconscious and that creative connection into our waking life and revitalize it in that way. And I just really get excited about that idea.
Well, I'll go you one step further and suggest that there are moments in our life where waking life seems very dreamlike and perhaps vice versa.
Yeah.
Because this, it gives me a lot of respect for some of the Aboriginal ideas of dream time and the fact that, you know, that there is a dreamlike quality, at least, to what we're experiencing. You know, and again, bringing in Jung and synchronicity, oftentimes real life will line up in ways that we interpret as meaningful, and it's very compelling. You know, it might line up along the lines of dreams we've had, or it might line up in that sort of uniquely coincidental way that connects to a series of circumstances or other people in ways that we don't expect. But there's often, when one follows that and connects with that, if one's on a deep spiritual path, it's pretty common to experience a chain of synchronicities that can make you feel that you're experiencing a living dream. And if you talk about those kinds of experiences to some psychotherapists working traditionally, you might have to be careful about getting a diagnosis of some kind of psychosis condition.
right, yeah. But I always think that when you're doing that kind of work, it's important to ground, and it's important to notice what's testable in your environment so you don't kind of wig out and go off, you know, go too far off. But that those synchronistic experiences are so rich, and that there's something about the mystical experience where when you ground into the experience that you're having, noticing the tangible, you know, pieces of noticing what your body needs and these things, that it actually can be a very, very rich and evocative experience and can be so magical and yet so grounded. Like the two can happen simultaneously.
Yes, but I wish I could remember at the moment who said we must be willing to go too far in order to understand how far too far is.
Absolutely.
I probably really butchered that quote, but
but I get what you're saying, like the whole idea that, you know, you have to embrace the entire experience. You can't put the brakes on. You have to kind of find a way to well, I always think of the moon card in the tarot, the idea that, you know, it could be illusion or it could be illumination, but you have to stay in that place of having the light shined on something long enough to delineate what the different objects are around you and what the energy is like. You can't just go into it, judge it, and then jump out. You know, you have to stay there for the whole piece of it.
Well, and there may indeed be value to what we label as madness or psychosis or things that seem like those things in our life. And we haven't nearly given that nearly enough respect or reverence. Tragically, sometimes I think people are hospitalized who are having a genuine, what Stan Grof would call spiritual emergency. You know, playing on the words emergence versus emergency as crisis, that a lot of times we'll have these seemingly psychotic kinds of experiences where reality doesn't seem to be behaving as it ought to in our lives, or we're experiencing unique phenomena with regard to our bodies or having some class A mystical experience. We don't have a container or a cultural context for some of those things, at least not anymore. And too often, you know, the hospital is where that ends up getting contained quite inadequately.
And I think that going to a community environment where you're supported in your spiritual growth, like the crow's nest when I think about it now, so you can understand contextually what some of these pieces, what some of these opportunities to connect with spirit or connect with psyche are about on a larger level on your journey, can be so evocative, so important, and, you know, and that experience in and of itself can be grounding. And I'm sure, you know, for Indigenous nature-based kinds of tribal peoples was grounding in the tribe.
Indeed.
Cool. Awesome. Yeah, wow. Well, cool. Let me look at your bio and see what else I want to ask you. Or is there anything that you, I mean, like, you know, that you really want to share in this hour that you feel like the energy is going toward? Something you want to say?
Well, one of the things certainly that is very much in my heart and at the forefront of my awareness, especially as the DSM-5 is about to be published, mm-hmm. is to just offer folks the understanding and, dare I even say, the hope that there are therapists who are available that understand that not everything can be reduced to a label or mental illness. And if there is a hunger or yearning to work with a counselor or a psychotherapist or any kind of helping person in a way where they won't be diagnosed, where they won't be prescribed medication, there are still those ways of working even in this field. You know, it's ironic. I've been trained as a clinical psychologist. I'm supposed to be grounded in the psychopathology model, but so much, you know, I work in a counseling department, which is always more open to wellness models, wholeness models, and those kinds of things in my own experiences and formal and informal kinds of training experiences I've gotten have really helped flesh out a non-pathology understanding of these things. So there are those of us out there doing that. And, you know, I think if you look for a good Jungian therapist, if you look for a shamanic counselor, if you look for, you know, someone who integrates body work with counseling, there's any number of possibilities or options. But some of us do try to keep a foot in more mainstream contexts as well as some of these, quote, alternative therapy contexts. And we are out there doing those kinds of things. And if insurance doesn't cover the work, one thing that I do is I really try to make my sliding scale accessible to anyone. Mm-hmm. And there is, you know, to me, ethically, money should never be an obstacle for someone finding healing. And those of us who make our living, say, as professors or teachers, have a little bit of freedom to charge lower rates for counseling, look for those folks, you know, because then there's a lot more freedom to work outside of the boundaries of insurance companies and diagnostic structures and those kinds of things.
Absolutely, absolutely. That's so appreciated. I think it's so important for sliding scale. It's so important to make it accessible to anyone who wants to do healing work or wants to do, you know, discovery kinds of work or intuition building work or any of that sort of stuff outside of the context of traditional psychotherapy. I think that's so important, and it's important to have it as a commitment to clients. So I really think that's great that you do and that you encourage people to be able to find that. Mm-hmm. And I think
and it's
too,
something I'm trying to open up with my students as well, you know. And let me tell you, contemporary graduate students who are looking to make their career do not want to hear that working with insurance companies sometimes isn't a mandatory thing. In fact, they've been so indoctrinated in their other classes.
Yeah.
It's like, well, how can you not? You have to work with insurance companies. And, you know, my challenge on that is, okay, well, who says you do? What do you think we did before there were insurance
That's
companies
great.
In this,
absolutely.
You know, entering into this domain?
Yeah, absolutely. Well, and I think, too, that some clients come to the realization that they're not going to get what they want out of a helping, you know, psychotherapist in a traditional kind of setting. And so they will, you know, come to an alternative kind of practitioner, like someone who does somatic work or someone who does Jungian kinds of stuff, and they go to it with more of a commitment about the process because they know that they're going to be met there in a different way than they'll be met in like a managed care facility or a traditional kind of facility. And I've seen that a lot, which I think is wonderful. You know, I mean, that is really when individuation, like that quote that you have for your counseling practice, when individuation really becomes something that we seek out on a regular basis, you know, and
yeah.
I think that's wonderful. And I think that the whole It's changing, that things are changing, and that people are seeking out practitioners who are less focused on, you know, cognitive behavioral, although cognitive behavioral certainly has its place with certain folks, but who are less focused on that, and who are more introspective, and who want to understand some of these other kinds of modalities and ways of going about things. I mean, I think it's changing a lot, you know, especially with the advent of coaching, you know, that's a whole nother direction to head in, and a way that is much more client focused often, you know.
Yes. Yeah, I mean, coaching has certainly offered some oftentimes uncomfortable challenges to the traditional ways of working in the mental health field. And, you know, of course, the critique of coaching is that they're not bound necessarily by the same ethics, so it's completely unregulated and all of those kinds of things. But certainly I can understand the appeal to someone who's looking for a healing relationship and wants the freedom to work with someone helping them in a way that's not overly rigid, overly structured. So, you know, there's, I guess it's sort of a two-edged sword in some respects when it comes
to
those things. But, you know, when it comes to insurance companies, lot of times I'm really leery of how many of my, even it seems like a lot of people in my profession will say things like, well, you know, I'll submit the diagnosis to the insurance company and I'll, you know, describe the treatment plan and then we'll do what we're really going to do. You know, if I was an insurance investigator, hearing something like that would certainly make me raise my eyebrows. And, you know, I don't want to necessarily raise the specter of insurance fraud here, but sometimes I think things skirt uncomfortably close with the amount of fudging that goes on, and don't think for a minute the insurance companies are unaware of this.
Yeah, I think that's true. I think that's true. I think that, you know, I think you're right about that. For sure. I think it's interesting, too. I mean, it's a whole other conversation, but I think it's interesting, too, how because we know that happens so often with counseling kind of relationships, that doesn't make the insurance companies go, like maybe we're not really actually fulfilling the need that we need to, but that's a whole nother conversation, you know. That's that larger, like collective, you know, the world is changing millennium kind of conversation.
Yes, well, that would lead us to a discussion of healing versus profit motive. And
well, yes.
So there's a whole other hour blown.
Absolutely. Well, I want people to know where to be able to get a hold of you for all of your services and for all of the work that you do. Drake.
Well, right now, my most active presence is on Facebook. So while I certainly don't want to exclude myself from people who are not on Facebook, you can very easily find me there. I have a page, White Raven Counseling, where I certainly post a lot of information about what I'm doing, my approach. I do have a website under construction, but I think I'll leave that because, as I said, it is under construction. Right now, the Facebook page is the best way of getting a description. But certainly, you know, anyone who desires my contact information, they certainly can feel free to get it from you, from the podcast. I'd be happy to make that available.
Awesome. And I just want to do a really quick plug for Crow's Nest. I was supposed to have C. Michael Smith on last summer, and we had this trip. We actually went up to see the Crow's Nest, and I couldn't get him on the program. There was something going on with Blog Talk that night, and it was funny because our whole trip was all about Trickster, and so then we couldn't get him on. And so then I just wove that into the whole, you know, archetype of the Trickster, you know, story. But I do hope to have him on soon, and think the Crow's Nest is a wonderful resource for folks who are looking for alternative ways of practicing and learning and knowing things. So
absolutely. I can't say enough good about McCall, and the community there is just this loving, authentic healing community where people who have very real issues also show very real signs of change in their lives, doing the good work that they do. And yes, you could do way worse than to have him as a guest on this show. I love to drink up much of what he says, because I once had a friend who went with me say, I wish he could just slow down because I can't write down everything he's saying, because everything he's saying is so important. You know, I've never been to someone with it where every sentence is just fraught with multiple layers of meaning.
Awesome, awesome. Yeah, I hope that this August we'll be able to go do one of his trainings. I've been wanting to do that for a while, so that is the plan. So yeah, absolutely. But thanks so much for being on Inner Voice Intuitive Hour this evening. Thanks for your insight and wisdom and perspective and all of that.
It was my pleasure, and thank you very much for having me as a guest.
Oh, you're so welcome. Have a great evening.
You too.
Bye-bye.
Bye.
That was Drake Spieth with White Raven Counseling talking about shamanic counseling. I just want to say really briefly, if you are finding in your own life that you're needing counseling, that you're needing support, that you're needing intuitive development, and that you're not finding it in your traditional environments, that we're out here and we do unique things and treat you as the very, very unique growing individual that you are. And we're open to different ways of practicing and viewing you as a client and working with you and creating a bridge with the divine in your life. So find practitioners who are depth psychology related, who are Jungian, who are shamanic, who do somatic body work and releases, and who talk about these things. If you're talking about them, if you're finding yourself talking about them in your life and not getting that need met, then it's perhaps time to find them in your circles and introduce them into your inner life, because we are out here. So thanks so much for listening to Inner Voice Intuitive Hour this evening. And whatever you do, go find magic, make magic, create magic, inspire magic, and feel magic in your lives, because that's a lot of what we're here for. Take care, guys. Bye.